I'd like to talk tonight about the the wonder of beingness. If at any point you can't hear me, Dina, just give me a thumbs up or a sign, okay? Not all human beings are interested in or even aware of the possibility of release from the perception of being a separate self. Some human beings live out that life of individuality and are relatively satisfied with their experience of living from first breath till last. The experience of individuality and even the feeling of separation that it brings for many human beings happens more or less every day. And yet, as we drop into deep sleep every night, all sense of individuality dissolves. It's completely gone. And even in the dream state at times, the night dream state, the sense of individuality may thin out. For example, the sense of being an individual body sometimes shifts significantly. And some of my friends fly often in their dreams. In fact, my friend recently I was with, he was flying in his dream, and he had me on his back. I wasn't there that I know of, but he had me flying on his back that night, and he told me about it the next morning. He said, we had a little problem when we got near the telephone wires, and he had to swoop down. That's a kind of intimacy, isn't it, you know? It seemed like it was a very happy experience for him to have me on his back flying around. The human being is going through the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state, over and over, day and night. And these so-called transitional zones between waking state, deep sleep state, dream state, waking state, and so forth, and on it goes. Anywhere along that, you could say, continuum, the sense of individuality and the sense of separation can thin out or completely go away, and then once again reappear. So a little over a year ago, I was noticing that a certain kind of unhappiness had arisen. And it was an unhappiness that had with it confusion, and it had a degree of anguish about it that was quite absorbing at times. And I made a decision to go into some therapy to explore this. And so I went out to California to work with a particular therapist, trainer that I felt safe with, that I trusted. And I did some work with him and some other people, and it was quite useful for me, actually, some very sort of deep, yet untracked down emotional pain came out. And it was quite good for me. However, I mention this not so much for the, you know, notion of the value of working with other people in a close way at times therapeutically, but I mention it because what happened after I worked with him a bit, that night I had a dream. And in my dream, the Hell's Angels came. The Hell's Angels came to my class. I was teaching a class and the Hell's Angels showed up. And these Hell's Angels were male and female. And they were fully, you know, decked out in the vests and the chaps and the boots and the whole nine yards. And they blew into class and they just filled the room. And they took over, basically. And I was diminished considerably. Like, I was in the middle of talking about something that I thought was fairly useful to the group, and suddenly the Hell's Angels absorbed the group, and they absorbed me. And then somebody in the Hell's Angels, who was rather large with a big voice, said, it's time to go outside. And so we went outside, and class resumed outside, and they had pickup trucks and motorcycles. And I do like motorcycles, but they had the pickup trucks and motorcycles. And suddenly we were having class in the back of the pickup trucks and on the motorcycles. And we didn't go out riding, but we were just hanging. And there was this sense of getting into it so much that I remember looking into this Hell's Angel's face, and we were just inches away, and I just felt love. Now, in the waking state, I have experienced some trepidation around the Hell's Angels and some concern for myself and my well-being at times, just my own reaction, of course. You know. So this sense of individuality can clearly appear and disappear, and it does, and it has been, actually, throughout this day. When the mind picks up what the scriptures say in their own way, and each scripture in its own way, regardless of the tradition, it has its own phraseology, it has its own way of putting it. But when the mind picks that up, it turns the ancient timeless truth into concepts and ideas about what liberation is, what freedom is, or what abundant living is. Now, words, as I said before, are not the truth. Just as the word is not the thing, words are not the truth. Just as honey is not sweetness. But notice how the mind associates honey with sweetness. In this same way, through experiences, through thoughts, senses, feelings, perceptions, and so forth, the mind has associated words with truth, just as it associates honey with sweetness. Yet at the same time this is going on, is it clear that what's going on here as life is completely and mysteriously beyond words? Completely, utterly, and mysteriously beyond words. And this is not a problem to solve. It's a reality to live. The message is always in the scriptures hidden. The actual essence is hidden. And somehow underneath the words, it's pointed to. Yet actually, it's impossible to write or articulate this ancient, timeless, mysterious truth of the way things really are. And so, historically, the parable has been used, the riddle has been used, the story has been used, the metaphor has been used. And I would say that's been done quite intentionally. Because often the one, so to speak, who's using the parable, the riddle, the story, is doing so because it's very clear to that one, so to speak, that what is being said is just pointing to truth. However, also, the fragrance, the texture, the ambience of the unspeakable mystery is always there. And when I say there, I mean here. Because if we think about something that's touched us scripturally, something that we've read, something that we've heard, something that we say, something that we've written down, that really resonated, that is here. There is here. It's just the thought that suggests otherwise. So the mind, in its infinite, you might say, creativity, often gets a hold of the spiritual practice, and it doesn't just get a hold of it, which can be a very good thing, prior to being exposed to teachings of meditation, one might have felt that one's life was worse off. And in fact, others might have told us so. Once you start meditating for a while and you get around your friends, if you start acting up, don't be surprised if they say, "You need to meditate." Have you been on your cushion lately? Of course, they might need to meditate too. But what gets going in there is not just that meditation's healthy, not just that meditation feels good at times. If this didn't feel good some of the time, then this would be darn right intolerable. Okay? If there at least wasn't the release at the bell sound, right? Or the food. Time to eat. You can always tell who likes to eat. If you don't see him smiling in the hall or walking around here, but you see him in the dining hall and suddenly the smile has appeared. For me, the food line was often a difficult spot. Because one of the first times doing Vipassana that the bliss came, then the bell rung and it was time to get in line for food. And I'm trying to sustain my first and only deep state of bliss that has ever arisen. And it's time to eat. So I get into the food line, and I'm literally wobbling because this bliss is pouring down from the top. It's just like a shower. And I'm like, this is great. And then all of a sudden, I was in front of the spaghetti. And it was time to put it on my plate. And so I piled it on. Quite unconsciously. And as I came out from the line there with the food, I literally almost spilled it all over the floor. Quite a moment of, you know, is it more important to be blissful or centered? Well, years later, my partner in crime, that's my dear wife, mother of our children, used to do this stuff together. Once she saw me at another occasion piling on what she considered to be too much food, and she then had her own share of judgment mind in the form of, all those other people are fine, but my husband's a pig. See, in a way, the mind has no pride. It'll do anything within its own sphere. The mind doesn't just get a hold of spiritual practices. It then begins to believe that spiritual practices are required for awakening. Spiritual practices are required for awakening. And you have to be ready for it. You got to be initiated. And in some cases, in parts of our world right now, you got to pay a lot of money. Otherwise, you don't get in. Meanwhile, there's another phenomena unfolding underneath, before and after that story, and it's simply this. Awakening is a pathless land. And it's beyond civilization, culture, gender, race, time, and any activity. Now that can sound like bad news or disturbing news to the identified one or individual who's trying to awaken. But if that one's ready to relax, a little or a lot, those words just spoken are tremendous relief. You mean I don't have to shave my head or get a rishi knot or dress in white or be vegetarian or sit for 7 years straight I mean, just imagine that. What if I said, tomorrow morning when we come in here, after breakfast, we're going to sit just up until noon and don't move. I mean, just don't move. Just sit from 7 or 8:30 until 12 and don't move, okay? Just do that. And now we've been sitting for 45 minutes, okay? And a lot gets going, right? And the mind might say, wow, you know, that could be very interesting. Could also say, holy smokes, that's really intimidating. That could be frightening. You know, I could die. Or my leg could fall off. Awakening is a pathless land beyond civilization, culture, gender, race, beyond time and any activity. Awakening is beyond any activity or endeavor, therefore it requires no preparation or initiation. Yet it seems earnestness historically among humans is a common characteristic among the humans who awaken from the dream of separation. I mean, just take a few examples. If you know the story of the Buddha, you know something about some earnestness. If you know the story of Milarepa, great, great teacher, Tibetan teacher, when his audience asked him one time, how did you come to these insights you're sharing with us? He simply leaned over and pointed to his leathery behind. Been sitting a little bit. Look at the life of Jesus as it's been told to us. Look at what was faced, encountered, endured. And on the examples go. Look what Gandhi had to do to bring a certain liberation to the Indian people. Look what Martin Luther King was compelled to do to bring a certain liberation to people whose skin color is different than the dominant ones in the society. Earnestness seems to be the common characteristic. We've heard the word, we played with the word, we think about it maybe, the word disciple. What does it mean? Why is the word disciple different than the word devotee? Years back, in sharing this kind of event, being a part of this with folks, someone came into a small group meeting. She was a bit worked up, irritated, feisty, and, you know, wanted to work on it. Okay. So she said, where's the celebration here? This is really mundane. Now, meanwhile, she was anguished. You might just say angry. Annoyed. Wasn't quite getting that was something that she was generating in relation to this situation. Was wondering where the celebration is. So we had a good talk about things like celebration and how you can set them up on Tuesday at 3 with your friends, or you can get somebody else sometimes to give you a birthday party, or they'll do it sometimes and surprise you. But then there's the celebration of what is. There's a celebration of things as they are. There's a celebration of breathing and living alive in the what-isness of breathing, of sensations, of thoughts, of feelings, of silence. There's the celebration unfolding itself through every experience. We talked about that. And she let go a little bit of the idea that there wasn't any celebration here. Also, people question the silence and walking in this way and looking kind of zombie-like. Where's the devotion? Well, I would say, can you think of a more profound and complete devotion than to the very moment as it is? Can you think of something to be more in love with if you're going to be devoted than what's actually occurring? And if you still need your celebration, you need your special bubbles of love moments, you can have those too, if you can work that out. Receiving teachings is a funny game, because there's a part of the mind that doesn't want to be told what to do. Have you noticed? And it definitely doesn't want to be told how to be. So I remember the years, it's quite a number of years ago, and doing some study with a teacher named Joseph Goldstein. Some of you may know Joseph Goldstein or know of him. And Joseph, when he first got exposed to Dharma, he'd done some reading or had received a tape or two, and he had the idea he's going to go meditate. So he got a cabin in Vermont. A friend offered the cabin, and he went up there, and he had his zafu and his zabutan, and he had his rosary, and he had his incense sticks, and he even had his bug tarp. One of those things that you hang down. The mosquito net. And he had it all set up. And he got up there and it was like a throne. And he was all ready to meditate. And he didn't know what the hell he was doing. And he realized, I need someone to guide me. It's a funny thing, because in a way, receiving the teachings, when they're received, they only go to the wisdom that's already there. The wisdom that's already there within you awakens. And we misunderstand this sometime, and we think that somebody's giving us something. I like to receive teachings from people anytime, any place. Human beings awaken in all kinds of circumstances. Every now and then, my partner, my wife, my devoted friend, will pop out a teaching or two. The other morning, she said, just came out with it. Alice, she starts out. Alice was a Cherokee Indian with an adopted white son of 2 years old. I lived with her. I'm like, why didn't you tell me this before? I didn't say this. Why didn't you tell me this before? I've been with you for 20 years. Where'd you get this? Anyways, this is going on back here, so keep quiet, Paul. Are you going to receive a teaching or are you going to jump in? She goes, Alice, Cherokee Indian, was living in abject poverty. And Alice used to say to her son, listen. Listen. And then my wife commented, and she said, I hope you understand that Alice wasn't saying, listen to the sound. Alice was saying, stop and open And then she concluded, "I love that 2-year-old boy." And then she walked away. Notice what your mind, heart, did with that. What we really are is incomprehensible to our minds, to our thoughts. The mind tries to understand the ancient, timeless truth of the way things are, and it can never make it. It sets up the goalposts, the mind does, and then it tries to cross the goal lines. It tries to possess or obtain or acquire what is unpossessable, unobtainable, and what cannot be acquired. And even after the mind hears, and it may hear this many times, the truth is a pathless land. It goes on in its own ways, sometimes very subtle, creating paths and attempts to come to realization. Because it doesn't know what else to do. This busy mind of ours, it doesn't know what else to do when it comes to these matters. It can refuse over and over to be sidelined. It must be in the game. And it wants a touchdown. And even if that touchdown is just release from the sleepiness, or the dullness, or the sloth, or the torpor, or the uneasiness, it wants change. And again, it does this because it's been trained to do it. The mind has been conditioned and trained to behave this way. And so when it enters into a situation of meditation, it exercises its habit. And much of the thinking that's been going on through the mind today and yesterday and most days is of this nature. And please, understand I'm not bashing thought. Once it's clear that thoughts appear and disappear, that their intrinsic nature is impermanent, and they don't represent who you are fundamentally, then what can happen is you get the gift of being able to creatively use thoughts for whatever endeavor you might want to. Writing, speaking, thinking about things, understanding certain concepts in life, science and whatnot, with those thoughts. Very useful if you want to do that. That's a byproduct of the loosening of the brain and the thinking mind. And then it becomes very fun to think. And to direct and see the usefulness of thought rather than be used by thoughts and feel imprisoned in them. And I've heard more than once today the prison of the thinking mind. The mind can hear that you are actually closer to who you really are in the nothingness of sleep. And yet it can go on trying to realize, trying to awaken in the waking state by all manner of practices and methods. Now here's one key thing, and there's usually a couple keys that come out in these talks that is the whole deal, really. Okay, and here's one of them. Give a preface. These attempts at understanding, at awakening, liberation, freedom, peace, these attempts are forever futile and disappointing. It's an impossible situation. And it's exactly, here we go, here's the key, it's exactly the realization of the impossibility of acquiring freedom, peace, awakening. It's exactly the realization of the impossibility of that, that cracks the lid and allows awakening to emerge. Okay? So, for some of us, the deep feeling of futility is a critical turning point, a reckoning with the limits of effort, concept, discipline, and time. A very, very potent story is apt for this point. It's a story of Dipa Ma. Some of you may know of Dipa Ma. Dipa Ma was one of the teachers of Joseph Goldstein. Dipa Ma was a housewife in Bombay. Again, another situation of abject poverty. Mud floor, shack. Numerous children, husband. For reasons that probably could be somewhat explained and not explained, if I've got the story right, two of the children pass away either from illness or accident, and the husband dies. And it absolutely shatters her. Broken. As the story goes, she literally crawled into the meditation center. She crawled on her hands and knees into the meditation center, absolutely futile, broken, and desperate. And she received the Dharma. It's the receiving of that Dharma in this story, in her case, that awakened a woman of such metta, metta is loving kindness, that the aura of metta around her body was so palpable that anyone who wasn't completely distracted could feel that aura and feel that love emanating. I think of Dipa Ma at times of meals often, because during the meal periods on retreat, Dipa Ma would often be observed doing her walking meditation. 12 steps or 15. Broken, absolute shatteredness, complete futility. And then the turning took place for Dipa Ma. It's exactly the realization of the futility of our efforts to awaken to what we already are that cracks the lid and allows awakening to pop through. And no one makes that happen. Just like no one's breathing this breath, no one's sensation in these sensations. Part of our challenge is that we've learned that we need to change ourselves or purify ourselves or know ourselves or make ourselves over in some way that will then set up the possibility for awakening. And this again is a deep trance. It's a deep conditioning phenomena that you must be different somehow. And not only this, but when the mind has conceptualized what it thinks the truth is, for example, if it's conceptualized what it means when the phrase, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, or I have come so that you may have life and have it abundantly, or not that which the eye sees, but that whereby the eye sees. Know this and this alone to be Brahman, the eternal, not what people here adore. When the mind conceptualizes these scriptural phrases, it inadvertently turns truth, freedom, awakening abundant living into an object, into an event, into an occurrence, and therefore it's something to acquire. Our whole challenge is that we've believed, to varying degrees, that something different needs to happen. And when the world appears to us as objects, which it so often does, object of sight, object of sound, object of smell, object of taste, object of feeling, object of thought, and on these objects go. When the world appears to us as objects, then there must be a subject to whom these objects are occurring. And that subject is the observer. Now let's look at this for a moment. The observer, which is again part of the dream of the separate individual, or me, the observer is deeply believed in, and there's a deep belief that I am the observer. Yet no one can locate or find this observer. And as this insight dawns, then there's a loosening that can take place. A little or a lot of loosening. And it becomes clear that actually there is no observer, but there's something more akin to observing. See that? There's no fixed observer, but yet there seems to be observing going on. There's no fixed witness, but there seems to be witnessing going on. And here we have, again, the succinct and poignant, subtle and deeply cutting message of the Buddha. Actions without an actor. Doings without a doer. The mind hears this. Actions without an actor. Doings without a doer. And what does it mean? There it goes, perhaps, trying to sort that out. And yet, even as it hears this, a loosening may happen, a kind of a shift, an easing, actions without an actor. Since I can't find the observer, I can't find the witness, and what seems to be happening is more akin to witnessing or observing, and then the Buddha says, actions without actor, doings without a doer. What import does that have with regards to awakening? And even as some shift around these words may take place, some recognition, some resonance, some yes, that's clicking. Even as this shift is in motion, there can still be a very strong belief. And the belief can go like this. What I am really looking for is going to happen in the future. There are actions but no actor, doings but no doer, watching but no watcher, observing but no observer, sense of I but no I that I can locate and pin down, and yet if I'm to truly comprehend or know what these words of the Buddha mean, it's going to happen in the future. And that's predicated on a belief that it's not happening now. And so, for many people, the insight arises over and over that there is no future except for thoughts or ideas or projections or imaginations. That's all the future is. There's nothing out there called future. That which we call future only arises here as thoughts about what might be, whether that's feared or desired. Even as that's happening, still the investment, things will somehow set right in the future that will ease the strain, relieve the suffering, bring the happiness, and this dance can go on unabated. What happens sometimes for humans when they're sitting in meditation like this is that this, what I'm describing right now, gets utterly clear. And it can be quite a conundrum. The desire to be released from suffering, or anything that appears inhibiting and binding, can actually be so spellbinding, so entrancing, that it fuels the fascination with personal endeavor, and that personal endeavor infuses itself right inside the meditation. And as I said last night, worth saying again, the personal endeavor or success or accomplishments are perfectly fine when it comes to jobs or athletics, making apple pies or tying your shoes. My 13-year-old son hasn't quite got that yet. He still demands that I tie at least one of his shoes in the morning. We're kind of working on that one. It's better when you do it, Dad. Do the left one. Do the right one. And so we're playing, we're dancing with this place of control. Because it's like, if I can get you to tie my shoe, I've got you. And it's a fun space. When it comes to tying the shoes, making the apple pies, serving other people, painting a house, writing a paper, giving a talk, designing a program, showing up for a relationship. These things are worth learning to succeed in. Let's be very clear that a problem, very fundamental problem, can arise when we apply that same accomplishing tendency into the nature of awakening and what it actually is, into discovery of our true or original nature. So we get into the meditation, the contemplation, the prayer, the self-inquiry. And if we're not careful as we engage in these activities, we can be inadvertently reinforcing the idea that we're somebody who's going to achieve and acquire and obtain and succeed. And it's a dream that the individual, separate me or I, is playing out. Awakening, in part, is to see that dream as a dream, in the same way you would probably label tonight's mental, emotional, physical activity when you awaken in the morning as a dream. In that same way, the parading of the individuality as the centrality of who and what you are is a dream. So we can get into this thing called effort, and we may have studied about what effort means and right effort. And then we get to the point in studying right effort and we hear or we get a sense that right effort actually means no effort. And those moments of no effort arise for many human beings every single day. But they often go unnoticed because the consciousness is dulled. The awareness is not sensitized. It's often looking for something special, looking for something spectacular, looking for something big. And not only that, but is looking for that something special, something big to happen to itself. So we work on what it means to relax. And if we hear somebody like me saying, relax, and then we go in and we sense what that is. If we can only go a little deeper, let go a little more, not only might I feel better, but I maybe be free. Maybe. And yet, through this story that I'm telling, the ancient timeless truth that no one awakens can begin to echo and come forth. No one awakens. Awakening is an accident. And all these methods and practices do is allow you to be accident prone. Words are useful sometimes. What does the word accident mean? A happening that is not expected. Unforeseen, unintended, happening by chance, and let's not forget, fortuitous. Awakening is a fortuitous happening to no one, like an accident. You might call it good fortune, not good versus bad. Awakening happens to no one, and what that means is awakening occurs when seeking, longing, and needing falls away. When seeking, longing, and needing anything at all to be any different at all falls away. There's the crack. The lid just came off. You see that? Awakening happens to no one. No person awakens. Awakening is when the dream of individuality falls away. That's what awakening is. And so the seeker is looking for what was never lost, and therefore it cannot be found. What the seeker is actually looking for is what's actually already here and now. And what's sought is already everything as it is. Yet everything as it is only awakening when there's no one claiming it. The sense of I is actually an aspect of beingness. What is sought and in fact always already occurring is beingness itself. Beingness continues to arise as misery, as suffering, and all other forms of experience. But once it's realized that this misery or suffering is not happening to anyone, then awakening has struck. You see, the one who wants to be relieved from suffering, when that one dissolves, that's the awakening. And the so-called suffering can continue. But its implication is radically and fundamentally different. Trees, rocks, clouds, all sorts of animals are being. And yet as soon as the perception of me or the story of individuality is seen for what it is, then it too is seen as beingness. The story of me can continue. And now it too joins the tapestry of beingness instead of holding itself apart and separate and then trying to acquire wholeness and completeness. So this beingness, it settles down deeply into the nothingness of sleep. And then this beingness arises as everything with the first thought in the morning. We've identified ourselves as a human being and other beings as different beings. The fundamental nature of things as they are is beingness. All of it. The realization that the individual only exists as a concept or an idea is what reveals that life is essentially one. Life is essentially whole, and it's indivisible. There are no divisions anywhere. It's the idea that I am an individual that creates all the perceived divisions. When that's gone, all there is wholeness. So then, in realization, nothing is gained. But instead, the concept of individuality is decentered or lost. And with the concept of individuality lost, separation then dissolves and unicity shows. This is why the human being, in many cases, when they're seeking fulfillment through being entertained, I want to be entertained. I want to go to the movie and lose myself. I forget my agony. I forget my story. I forget my concern. I forget my money issues. I forget my this and that. I lose myself in the story of another being. And in so losing myself in those moments, I am relieved from my individual drama and story. Notice that. How many human beings, including us at times perhaps, have pursued those kinds of experiences. I want to forget myself. I want to lose myself in beingness of deep sleep. How about that one? I want to lose myself in the beingness of the narcotic. I want to lose myself in the beingness of meditation. I want to lose myself so I can find myself. All that's arising is arising as being. Everything is being itself. All forms of experience are simply being themselves. Beingness is the fundamental essence. And here's a very important point. Being is beyond awareness or knowing. Awareness or knowing are aspects of beingness. Awareness is being aware. Knowing is knowing. Objects are being themselves. Trees, rocks, flowers, plants, dogs, cats, ants. Sentient, insentient, fundamental essence is beingness. Not only is beingness beyond awareness and knowing, being doesn't need to know anything. Doesn't need to do anything. Doesn't need to change, even though it's ever changing and new. Doesn't need to. This is so utterly and completely simple. But the mind sometimes goes, it can't be that simple. It's got to be more than that. Being is both empty and full. And can never be possessed. Trying to possess it would be like trying to catch space in a net. Everything that's arising as it is, all things our being. So then it's also silence and stillness. Silence and stillness of being themselves. Fullness in all things. Emptiness. Anything nameable and that which is unnameable. All of it is being. How does this connect to the Heart Sutra? If you've studied the Heart Sutra, then you're studying the heart of the sutras. The opening line, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Why is form emptiness? Because form is empty of solidity. All forms, have you noticed, are empty of solidity. Even that most painful sensation in your knee is empty of solidity. Maybe not right there before the bell rings, but once you start to move. Why else is form emptiness? Because all forms are empty of ownership. They are unpossessable. Sensations, breathing, thoughts, all objects, unpossessable, owned by no one. Doesn't matter how many times you write your name on the title, you still don't own the house. Only in conventional terms. We've agreed that it's yours if you bought it. Or the bank owns it, and you're paying them. To get this is to get the sense that you don't exist as you thought you did. The other reason why form is emptiness and emptiness is form is because form and emptiness are one in beingness. Emptiness is being emptiness. Form is being form. Emptiness is form. Form is emptiness in beingness. They are both being themselves. Fullness opens as you realize you are space. And emptiness appears when you look for the one that things are happening to and you cannot find him or her. He or she cannot be found. And so in emptiness and silence, life's fullness and completeness presents itself as presence. You could say presence is that which is most personal and at the same time completely transpersonal or impersonal. That means common to all. Common to everything. Beyond any idea of anything, prior to any idea of anything, there is the presence of being. And all things are as they are in beingness. And so then everything is being itself as presence. I'd like to conclude this talk with a passage which exemplifies this in terms that are, I feel, very, very striking. I'm going to just read this as it's written. I have been fascinated and waylaid by abstraction, that means interpretation, dreaming about the life I would prefer to have rather than living the experience of what is. What I abstract never really comes to be. It only sometimes flickers into life like a watered-down approximation. This abstraction is like a smokescreen born from longing or frustration, offering me a holiday of dreams. It is always safe, predictable, and an indulgence in the known. If I stopped abstraction and move my awareness for an instant into my bodily sensations, I discover there is a huge symphony going on. Not necessarily in tune, but nevertheless constantly changing and moving, coming and going. Something arises, then disappears, followed by something else arising to take its place. There is very little that I can control or manipulate. It is immeasurable and unknown, coming into being and then passing away. In the same way, if I let go and listen, touch, taste, smell, or see, there is no way of knowing beforehand the exact qualities of those sensations. I could say that I can anticipate the sound of a bird singing, but it is only information based on memory, and neither alive nor vital. The sound I actually hear, the sound of what is, will never be the same as my abstraction of it. When I first listen to the sound, I will try to grasp it and label it in order to control it. When I let go of that control, there is simply the listener and the sound. When the listener is dropped, there's only sound. I am no longer there. There is simply the naked and vibrant energy of what is. Nothing is needed, all is fulfilled. It is within the very alchemy of this timeless presence that freedom arises. Life beckons me, it whispers, it calls, and in the end, it screams at me. The scream of crisis or disease is often what will bring me to the rediscovery of who I really am. For it is difficult to abstract suffering. And finally, moving from our original and timeless nature into consciousness identified, we have created this circumstance in order to rediscover that the dream we are living has absolutely no purpose other than our awakening from it. That awakening emerges outside of the dream, outside of time, and it is completely beyond the grasp of individual effort, path, process, or belief. We have created this circumstance in order to rediscover that the dream we are living has absolutely no purpose other than our awakening from it. May all beings awaken from the dream of separation. May all beings be touched by the Heart Sutra. May all beings awaken into a life of abundance. We could sit for a couple minutes now, please.